This is Jill Burridge, and we're doing our occasional look at audiobooks that are available from the local library. And I'm joined today by Helen Pekku, who's from Hertfordshire Library Services. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
The first two books that you've chosen today are really short stories. Well, one's slightly longer stories, but the first one that you've chosen is Hilary Mantel's The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher.
Yes, that's right. There are 10 short stories in this set, and they're all very different.
She's, of course, a prize-winning author for her books about Thomas Cromwell, Bring Up the Bodies, Wolf Hall, etc., which have been televised recently. But she's written a lot apart from Wolf Hall and Thomas Cromwell. And these are a collection of stories that I think she's sort of written over the years, aren't they?
I think so, yes. They've all appeared in various journals and newspaper articles and that sort of thing, and were put together as a collection last year. They were published.
The first one and the last one being The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher, which caused, just by its title, quite a bit of controversy. They're both about intruders, aren't they?
That's right, yes. And quite similar the way they start off, with a lady on her own in a house. Somebody knocks on the door, she opens the door. But of course, they take a different direction. And the first one is actually based very much on Hilary's own experiences when she herself lived in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. And it's almost what happened to her, I think.
It has a sort of claustrophobic feel about it, doesn't it? Because she is very much kept to the flat where they live. Her husband works. She's living on the in a flat on a compound, and she really can't go out. She's not well. She's on a lot of medication, and the way she describes the heat and the silence of her flat is quite chilling, really, isn't it?
Yes, it must be very oppressive to live like that. Women obviously are very restricted, even foreign women. They can't really go out uncovered. There's no cinemas in Saudi Arabia. There's no sort of form of entertainment. So she has to sort of make her own entertainment with a few people who live in the complex. And also she's on medication, which is affecting her sort of view of everything there as well.
Mm. And then one day, the story is based around the fact that she allows a Pakistan businessman into the flat to make a phone call, and the story develops from there.
And she wonders if she's done the right thing, because this chap keeps coming back, but he actually turns out to be fairly friendly, but she's not sure if she's done the right thing.
And he persists in visiting her, and she becomes a bit annoyed actually with him returning.
She does, and he brings his family as well, two little children, and he's got an American wife, but then that doesn't seem to be going well. So I think she's quite happy when he doesn't come back again.
It's quite bizarre in a way, the story, isn't it? And several of the other stories, I felt I was waiting for something to happen, and it didn't really happen in some of them. They're quite disjointed episodes in a way, aren't they?
If you're expecting a twist at the end of every story, then you'll be disappointed. But that's not to say that they're not enjoyable to listen to, because her powers of observation, the way she looks at human nature, that's what these stories are about, looking at interactions between people. And the other stories have elements of infidelity in them. There's one about anorexia, all different themes. And she's just really observing people's nature.
Let's have a little taster. You've chosen an extract from one story, which is called Offences Against the Person. Do you want to just set the scene for us?
Well, all of these stories in the collection are in the first person. And so in this one, it's a teenage girl who's going to work for her father during the summer holidays. And he's a lawyer, a solicitor. And he is actually having an affair with his secretary. It's set in the 70s. And so this extract is just describing this secretary.
Her name was Nicolette Bland, and she was my father's mistress. I'm going back to the early 70s. It's a long time now since he was subject to urges of the flesh. She looked like a Nicolette, dainty, poised, hair short and artfully curling, dark, liquid, slightly slanting eyes. She was honey-coloured, as if she'd had a package holiday, and she looked rested and seldom not smiling. I put her at 26. I was 17, and filling in the summer before university as a junior clerk in my father's chambers. Devilling, he called it. I never knew why. I used to watch her type, clip-clip, little darting movements of her pearlescent nails. "They say women never learn to type," I offered. They were just beginning to say it, round 1972.
So that's an extract from Offences Against the Person. I particularly liked the story, which was obviously drawn from Hilary Mantel's own experiences, where as an author she went to talk to a literary group and she had to travel and they were supposedly putting her up somewhere nice. But when she arrived, the bed and breakfast where she was given accommodation was absolutely revolting, and her descriptions made me sort of feel I wanted to be physically ill. Actually, they were so powerful.
That's one of her strengths, the fact that she can just sort of make these observations and describe, and you feel that you're there.
And she then, in that final story, which is the title of the whole book, The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher, she sort of uses that, because inadvertently she's expecting a plumber to come to her flat, and instead this Irish terrorist arrives who wants to take a pot shot at Margaret Thatcher. And Hilary Mantel sort of uses that to her own end to give her views about Margaret Thatcher, doesn't she?
She does, and in fact she's on record as hating Margaret Thatcher and doesn't sort of want to cover that up at all. But this story is set actually in real time that happened, where Margaret Thatcher was going to an eye clinic or was just leaving after an operation. So it could have happened, and you know, you sort of read through to the end and you'll see it could have happened. It's very clever, just the interaction between the lady in the house and this sort of IRA terrorist.
They are very clever stories, actually, aren't they? And her style of writing is really gripping, I think. So that's The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher, and it's by Hilary Mantel. So continuing with shorter stories, we're going on now to James Runcie and his third set of stories about Sidney Chambers, who is a vicar, actually, but he has inclinations towards investigating crime, doesn't he?
He ends up falling into these sort of crimes, helping out, because they're set in the 60s and sort of 50s, these stories, and he obviously was a key part of the community. So, you know, he hears things and people confess things to him that, you know, they perhaps wouldn't to other people. So he's in a good position.
Sidney Chambers actually is the vicar of Grantchester, which is just a little village outside Cambridge. So that's the setting for all the stories. And that setting is rather good in itself, isn't it? You get very much a feel for Cambridge, the sort of flat terrain around the city and the historical side of all the, you know, colleges and his circumstances, etc.
Yes, you do. And he goes into Cambridge quite a bit, and in the stories, you know, describing the streets. So if anyone knows Cambridge, you'll be able to sort of visualise that.
This new book is called Sidney Chambers and the Problems of Evil. But in the first two books, he's formed a sort of friendship with Keating, who is a detective, and they meet every week, I think, in the pub, don't they?
They do, yeah. They have a sort of weekly gathering in the local pub to play backgammon, and that's where, you know, they catch up on the events that have been going on in all the villages.
And that's how your extract that we're going to hear now actually starts.
After they'd got in the first of their regulation two pints and sat down by the window, he complained that his grey hairs were edging remorselessly upwards. His belt had loosened not one but two notches in the last few years, and that his need for reading glasses made him look like a civil servant. "And not a very well-dressed one either," he sighed. "That's true," Sidney said absent-mindedly as he laid out the backgammon board. "Are you agreeing I'm scruffy, Sidney? Your clothes are well lived in. Well, that's because the only people who get new clothes on my salary are the children. Not that I see that much of them. The demands of the job. It never stops, you know. Sidney told his friend about the two doves that they'd discovered on his doorstep and was alarmed when Keating began to take a particular interest. He assumed that he would have been accused of being overly suspicious, but in fact the reverse was the case. The inspector was all ears.
For those people who have heard of the first two series, I think Sidney's circumstances are slightly changed by the time we get to this new one in Sidney Chambers and the Problems of Evil. He's actually got married.
Yes, he has a German wife called Hildegard. And given that this wasn't that long after the Second World War, it is actually described in the book that how his relationship with his wife is seen as very positive with the enemy almost. She is a very sort of calming influence on him and sort of tries to bring him back down to earth when he gets a bit carried away with all this sort of amateur sleuthing.
Yes, his amateur sleuthing. They're quite sort of gentle stories, aren't they, in a way? I know they deal with crime, but they're not violent or gory.
Not at all, no. They're quite sort of, yeah, as you say, gentle, easy to listen to. Almost Agatha Christie-like in some respects, of the, just because of the pace of life then. And everything seems easily resolved. So,
but in the first one, he has to deal with vicars that are being popped off, basically.
Yeah, there's a serial killer on the loose. So that's the first story. And he sort of has these powers of deduction and he can sort of try and work out and question things that maybe the inspector, you know, hasn't considered.
They are quite mannered in a way, and you do wonder how Keating misses all the clues that Sidney Chambers manages to pick up, don't you?
And he kind of relies on Sidney in some respects, and every time he embroils him in another mystery, and his wife, Hildegard, oh no, can't you stop doing this? But he feels compelled, I think.
And what are the other story themes that he develops?
One of them is a famous painting disappears from an art gallery. A very attractive French girl walks into this gallery and tries to distract everybody by taking her coat off and all her clothes. And then this painting disappears. So that starts off the hunt for that painting. Another one is that he becomes a sort of minor film star and there's a film being made in the village and he's cast as a vicar. So you'd think that he'd be able to do that. And what seems like an accidental death during the filming, a drowning, turns out to be perhaps not quite as it first seems. And then the last story is that he investigates the theft of a child from a hospital.
These reminded me of Midsummer Murders in a way, that's the sort of tone of the stories, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. It's that sort of village setting, that very community spirit, and just somebody who's obviously, you know, shouldn't really be involved in solving crimes, manages to wheedle his way in and get to know everybody and find out the answers.
Of course, James Runcie, the author, is local to St Albans.
Yes, of course. His father was Robert Runcie. And in fact, he said that he has loosely based Sidney Chambers on his father.
Oh, really?
Yes. So I don't know what Robert Runcie would have made of it, but he said he would have been quite amused.
I think he probably would have been. So that's James Runcie's third in the series of Sidney Chambers books, and it's now an audio book, and the title is Sidney Chambers and the Problems of Evil. And earlier on, we were talking about Hilary Mantel's collection of short stories, The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher. So, Helen, going on to longer novels now, one that's been very, very popular and is on audiobooks now is Rachel Joyce's title, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. I think when this first appeared, when it was first published, It was long-listed for the Booker Prize, wasn't it? But it seemed to gather momentum, this book, one of those ones that word of mouth did great things for.
It's a very clever and interesting story and something a little bit different.
Tell us what the sort of theme of it is. It's about Harold Fry, obviously. He's just retired.
Yes, recently retired brewery salesman. And he receives a short letter from a former colleague called Queenie Hennessy. And she's in a hospice at the other end of the country, in Berwick-upon-Tweed, and he lives in Devon. And she's got terminal cancer. So he writes a short reply to her and just says to his wife, Maureen, he was just going to post the letter. And he keeps walking and decides he'll go to the next post box. And this goes on. And then he eventually takes up this remarkable pilgrimage.
At the start of his walk, he actually calls into the petrol station. And I think that's the extract that you've chosen, if you want to just set the scene for us.
Yes, he gets hungry, so he decides to go into the petrol station to get some supplies. And he gets chatting to a sales assistant there. She tells him something that really sticks with him and makes him make his decision.
You have to believe, that's what I think. It's not about medicine and all that stuff. You have to believe a person can get better. There's so much in the human mind we don't understand, but you see, if you have faith, you can do anything. Harold gazed at the girl in awe. He didn't know how it had happened, but she seemed to be standing in a pool of light, as if the sun had moved, and her hair and skin shone with luminous clarity. Maybe he was staring too hard, because she gave a shrug and chewed her lower lip. Am I talking crap?
Gosh, no, not at all. It's very interesting. I'm afraid religion is not something I ever quite got the hang of.
I don't mean, like, religious. I mean trusting what you don't know and going for it, believing you can make a difference.
She twined a strand of hair round her finger. Harold felt he had never come across such simple certainty, and in such a young person. She made it sound obvious.
So that extract comes from nearly at the beginning of the unlikely pilgrimage of Harold Fry. His journey then goes on. You have to slightly abandon credibility, don't you? Because I kept thinking, hold on, he hasn't got enough money. He hasn't got any changes of clothes. He hasn't got, you know.
Yeah.
And I had to, in the end, I just had to say, I'll have to forget that.
Yes, the fact that he's like a 65-year-old man, he's only got a pair of yachting shoes to begin with, nothing else. I think he's left his phone, everything at home, because he wasn't intending to walk. And he does actually get given things as he goes on, and he gets this entourage of people. Then he decides to sort of abandon it all and just go very simple again. So yes, there is an element of it that you think, how could this happen? But it's the spirit, I think, mind over matter, and the fact that he's got a mission.
This is 600 miles, this journey.
I know, I don't know. I mean, it takes him 3 months. I mean, it's pretty good going.
And meanwhile, his wife is sitting at home.
She's at home at a loss what's going on. Actually, what's quite nice about that part of the story is that you find out really the problems that are behind it all. They're not happy as a couple. They have a son, David, and you find out what happens there. She begins to see Harold in a different light as well. So her personality and her character change as well.
And he has quite an impact on the people he meets along the way too, doesn't he?
He almost becomes a guru. Everybody starts following him. They have their own reason for doing the walk. Obviously, his is solely he wants to get to see Queenie, hoping that she knows that he's doing this and that she will rally and stay alive. But all these other people follow him. So that part of the story becomes quite different, I suppose. And once they're all gone, it gets back to just him again, which is good.
It's sort of an allegory, isn't it, about a time to reflect and rethink and reevaluate your life.
He does a lot of thinking. I mean, that's also how the narrative moves on, that we find out as he wanders along, he's thinking about his past, what could he have done, why did things work out this way? And you learn about his own upbringing as well. He didn't have a happy childhood. That's quite a good way of the author bringing in all these other parts of the story.
Rachel Joyce, the author, I was reading before she started writing this novel, she had been writing radio plays. And I think she's written what she's called the companion book to The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, which is the story told from Queenie's side as well.
No, I haven't read that one, but that would be interesting, yeah, to see, because you do find out a bit about why Queenie was so important to Harold, even though they haven't worked together or even had any contact for a very long time. So, yeah, that would be interesting.
And this was one of those books that just took off. It was in the bestsellers for a long time then, wasn't it?
Yeah, sometimes stories like this just spark the imagination. It's a bit like The 100-Year Man Who Jumped Out of the Window. It seems to be a lot of stories about older people recently doing amazing things that capture the imagination.
Quite inspirational. Then you've chosen what seems on the surface to be a classic, but it's actually a rewriting of a classic. So this is a project that has been launched, the Austen Project. And the idea is that six contemporary, well-known novelists will undertake to retell the novels that Jane Austen wrote, which is a daring thing to do for any novelist, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, obviously, they're just such treasured classics. I'm not quite sure, you know, whose idea this project was, but they're all best-selling authors, the others being Joanna Trollope, Val McDermid, Curtis Sittenfeld. So far, I think there are still a couple more. They haven't got anybody to write. And obviously, Alexander McCall Smith is a best-selling author in his own right.
He's done the number one detective agency and quite a few other things.
Scotland Street, yes, loads.
Yes, he's very well known. And he has retold Emma.
Yes, he has. And I should mention that each author has to stick to the novel's existing plot and the characters, but they are free to make some changes. So don't expect any great rewriting because they have to have the main story. So basically what he's done is modernised it.
And he's set it in a contemporary setting.
Yes, it's modern day Norfolk. You've still got Emma and her family who are well-to-do. And you've got all the other sort of people in the village or the town who are just normal working class people as well.
So Jane Austen set out when she was writing Emma to create a character who, I have to say, wasn't particularly appealing to readers. You don't fall in love with Emma. She's quite a tricky madam, isn't she?
Yes.
And Alexander McCall Smith in his retelling has done the same.
She's quite a sort of stuck-up young lady. She's recently finished university. She's done an art degree or something like that. She wants to set up her own interior design business. And she does think she knows better than everybody else. So she's quite bossy.
You've chosen an extract from near the beginning, actually, where Mr. Woodhouse is interviewing Miss Taylor because she might become Emma's governess, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So when Emma and her sister were young, he decided he needed a governess. And Miss Taylor's my favourite character, actually, out of all of them in this particular version. She's quite good-natured and she doesn't suffer fools gladly, as you'll find out from this. She's the one who's going to be boss. So he puts an ad in the Lady and she answers it and comes along to be interviewed.
It did not take Mr. Woodhouse long to confirm his earlier suspicion that Anne Taylor would be exactly the right person for the job. "You seem to be entirely suitable," he said, a bare hour after her arrival. She seemed surprised by what he had said, and for a moment Mr. Woodhouse wondered whether he had unwittingly committed some solecism. He had been careful to call her Miss Taylor rather than Anne, even if that sounded rather formal, so it could not be that. Had he said anything else, then, to which she might have taken exception? "I have yet to indicate whether I shall accept," Miss Taylor said quietly. "One does not assume, surely, that the person whom one is interviewing wants the position until one's asked her." "But my dear Miss Taylor," exclaimed Mr. Woodhouse, "how crassly insensitive of me. I was about to raise that very issue with you, and..." "There is no need to resort to spin, Mr. Woodhouse."
What was it about the style of Alexander McCall's writing in this retelling of Emma that particularly appealed to you?
It's very sort of gentle writing, easy to listen to. There was nothing too taxing, and he throws in some little jokes and that sort of things. Yeah, a very light, easy read.
Were you a particular fan of the Jane Austen version?
Who can better Jane Austen, really? But it was interesting to see how he would manage to set it in a modern, you know, modern day. And there are some twists that he can sort of change slightly to adapt to our thinking.
So can you just tell us about the way Alexander McCall Smith has rewritten, in a way? He's used the village setting, which he's often used in his own books anyway, and he's done that again here with Emma.
Yes, it's a village in Norfolk again, so a small community where everybody seems to know everybody else, even in this day. And yeah, he does that a lot with his other novels.
Okay, so an interesting listen there. And just to recap on the title, this is Alexander McCall Smith's rewriting, retelling of Emma, the original story, of course, being by Jane Austen. And we were also talking earlier on about Rachel Joyce's novel, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, which is now also available as an audiobook. And earlier on, we were talking about James Runce's Sydney Chambers and the Problems of Evil, and Hilary Mantel's collection of short stories, The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher. Helen Pekku, thank you very much for joining us and giving us your pick of the best audiobooks that are available at the moment.
The music accompanying this edition of the Talking Bookshelf is called Good Times. It was composed and recorded by Goffby of Kenilworth, who's very generously given us permission to use his music.